Good morning, everyone. It is so good to be with you. Appreciate so much your putting God high on your list of priorities today, being here. Hope that through some of the things I'll be able to say this morning, we'll draw even closer to one another and closer to God for our time together. Very much appreciate those of you who are visiting with us. I hope you feel edified and welcome here, and invite you back anytime to join with our family here. Thought I'd speak this morning about parenting, thinking it's relevant. We have so many reminders of just becoming, that what it would be like, or what it is like to just become parents for the first time. In doing the bulletin, I have so many announcements of folks who are giving birth, and it's a real joy. It's a joy here in this congregation to have so many young families, and to have so many middle-aged families, and to have so many older families. I really think it's great for a congregation to have a good mix of all ages. And races, everything. I mean, the more mixed we can get, the better and the healthier it is. And I just think it's a healthy mix that we're working on here. I'm not so old that I can't remember what a rush of emotions and thoughts came my way when I learned we were going to have our first child. And largely, my commitment was just to be there, just to show up. I mean, I wasn't as involved in the process as my sweet bride was, you know. And it was still overwhelming for me. I can't hardly imagine what it's like for the women to find out they're expecting for the first time. It was so overwhelming to think about it. And I hadn't thought about it that much. I notice often when my wife is counseling my daughter, the phrase, you know, guys are clueless, shows up a lot. And you know, in a lot of areas, that's exactly right. Now, I was clueless when it came to children and how to raise them. And I was blessed that my wife, for her first 2 years in college, studied early childhood education, and then for the next two, studied speech pathology. And it seemed like if I had any question about child development, she knew the textbook answer. You know, I said, why can't he do that yet? Oh, well, that sound develops later, age 3 and a half, and you know, you shouldn't expect that yet. Oh, really? Okay, great. All right, I'll ease up on the little guy then, you know. all that stuff, I had no idea. I really had no idea, and I had to learn it. But I can remember wanting to be a good father and thinking, you know, I better study this. I better figure out how to be a good parent. And we did, and we tried to find information from different sources. And when we were first blessed as parents, we were members of the Episcopalian Church, and we had you know, different resources available than we would have had now. And I can remember going to the bookstores, and certainly when you go to the parenting section, it's true what they say in Ecclesiastes: of writing many books, there is no end. There's always a new book about how to parent. There's always a new idea about what the process should be. So many of those are conflicting as well, and it gets to be quite a confusing process. You know, what exactly should I do to be a good parent? Here's the Shameless Commerce Division promoting the class that we're going to give in a little bit of time. I mean, we have found finally some material that we really stand behind and think is great, and we're going to offer a class in a little while about that. But I don't want to come down to the point where, you know, you've got to take this class to be a better parent, to be a good parent. You can dispense with, I think, most of the exactly how-tos in every different scenario if you put one idea first. Actually, if you put one first. If you're considering becoming a good parent, I would propose that you become a godly parent. And if you can become a godly parent, see if you're not a good parent also. And I want to talk to you today about exactly what I mean by being a godly parent. And I'm going to use an example, I think, that's a little obscure, but hopefully you'll appreciate it. Let me ask you first, who exercises the greatest influence on a young person? You know, if there are siblings in the home, they have an effect. You'll notice if you've got older siblings, the young ones always trying to keep up with the older. You treasure the times when they're sitting together teaching one another, and when they're the first time that they can walk somewhere and the older one will take the younger one's hand and lead them. It's a precious thing. You're mindful of the times that they start fighting like cats and dogs, too. I mean, there's an effect there. But, you know, there's an effect that sibling has, influence that siblings have on each other. Relatives have an effect beyond the extended family. And I notice as I look around with our little ones in this congregation how often the relatives are involved, the grandparents holding them even now as I look around. It's a wonderful thing to have the relatives involved with parenting. For most of us, there comes, though, the dreaded first day of school. And if you're really unfortunate, they take a bus to school. And about that time, you've lost all control over them. Not all control, but I mean, they start to hear so much just on the way to school. And then, of course, the teachers have them for so long when they're in school. You can't minimize the effect that teachers have. It's an incredible thing. Elementary, middle, high school, college, grad school, teachers have a great effect, influence on children. The older they get, the more their friends are involved, and their friends speak to them and give them advice about how to do things, and they have a great influence. And as they get older and as their horizons broaden, they can look into all sorts of different areas. They can listen to music, and the musicians have an input. They have movies at their access and television, and those stars that are performing and the writers behind are giving them all sorts of ideas. They might take to the field of athletics and really follow a few of the role models there, whether they claim to be or not. And I've even heard of children occasionally picking up books and reading them, and the authors have an influence there as well. So there are all these different influences on our children, but Mom and Dad, you have the greatest influence on who your children are and what they become, and it is an awesome responsibility. It is through the physical father that the child begins to understand the heavenly father. It is through what dad is like that a child first, long before they can hold the abstract idea of what God is, who God is, and what he's like, they can see what dad is and know what dad is like. And so there's a direct correlation there. It seems to me that it's through the mother and her nurture that the child develops the real appreciation for Christ's love and what that is. And what an awesome responsibility that we're not just being mom and dad, but we're mirroring, we're letting the Lord's light shine through us. And whether we admit it or not, the children are going to see the Lord first through us and what we're like. And it brings to mind, what do our children already think of God from what they see in us? Well, it's an awesome responsibility. Since children get their view of God from their parents initially, and primarily, isn't it appropriate for us as parents to try to be as much like God as we can? And I mean that in the right way. I don't mean that we're actually going to be gods, but that we're going to be conformed to the image of his son, that we are going to be godly And there is the need for that. I want to lead you to an Old Testament example, point you to an Old Testament example of parenting that is worthy, they are worthy of our attention. But you know, they really don't get a lot of attention. They don't get spoken of very often. They're obscure in their being mentioned in the Old Testament and almost unknown. But they had a great influence on one, actually a great influence on all their children, who were remarkable children. And their influence was for good, and their influence was for God. And as they influenced their children influenced the world. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, it says, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a proper child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment." I don't want to exclude the influence of the Lord here and all that the Lord did to help develop Moses to be who he is. But don't the parents get some of the glory as well? The parents were mentioned here in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23. And if they've earned a place in the honor roll of the faith, isn't it appropriate that we give them a little bit of attention? But you really have to dig to find out their names. As you look in Hebrews chapter 11, it just refers to his parents. And even if you go back to the book of Exodus and chapter 2, where it first mentions them, it says there was a man and he has a wife and they were Levites. And it doesn't even tell you there. You have to go to chapter 6 of the book of Exodus in verse 20 to see them there mentioned by name, Amram and Jochebed. So it seems that fame isn't essential to being a good parent, and isn't that a good thing? I want to point you to three attributes of theirs that are worthy of our attention and our imitation. And the first attribute that they had was that they were people of vision. They were people of vision. They saw something. They saw something important and something other folks missed. It says here that by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child. It says also in other places that he was a beautiful child or a comely child. And it makes us sound like central to the process of their keeping him or parenting him was his good looks. And I think we miss the point if we think that this was driven by how handsome little baby Moses was. I think there's something else here. I think it's that all children are beautiful, that they're all of value, and they appreciated that. Do you remember what it says in Psalm 127, verses 3 through 5, what it says about children there? Let me read that for you. Psalm 127, verses 3 through 5. "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate." Do you see each child as a gift from God? That's the vision that I'm talking about here. That's the vision that Amram and Jochebed had. And they had that vision in a most difficult circumstance. Are you familiar with what was going on in the days just preceding Moses' birth? What had happened? The children of Israel who had been invited to sojourn in the land of Egypt had so proliferated that the Egyptians were threatened by their very existence. And they commanded that the midwives who assisted with the births of the children, be intentionally inept when the males were born, and through their inaction at the appropriate time, the male children were to die. That's what they had said would be the commandment throughout all of Israel. On the sly, Pharaoh was trying to make sure no male children would come to the Israelites. But the midwives wouldn't have it. They couldn't. They wouldn't do this heinous deed. And they explained, you know, those Israelite women are just so in such good shape, being out in the fields and everything. By the time we get there, the baby's already born and we can't mess things up and cause the child to die. So because that plan, that crafty plan didn't work, Pharaoh became more direct in his evil, less subtle, and said, all right, newborn males will be drowned in the river. You're to cast them in the river. And this was the edict upon every Israelite mother and father that gave birth to a male in the time that Moses was born. These are state-mandated executions of newborn babies. And it was in this scenario that Moses was born. But his parents saw that he was a proper child. His parents saw, and it came to them, you shouldn't do that to children. It's not right. I wonder how many other Israelites questioned the status quo. I wonder how many other Israelites, after giving birth, just went and tossed the child into the river. Doesn't really say, but it seems like most people complied with what Pharaoh said. Wonder how many asked, why are we doing this? Why are we going along with this? Do we have any other options? But we know that Amram and Jochebed saw the thing a little bit differently and handled the situation a little bit differently. They were people of vision. They were also people of valor. They had courage. Because seeing what they saw, they acted. And it says, they were not afraid of the king's commandment. And I don't think that means that they were just lawless people and whatever the king said they didn't go along with. But when they looked at the Lord's commandment about what you do with children, and then they looked at the opposing, conflicting commandment of Pharaoh, of the king, they said, well, in the face of those two, we can't regard what the king says. And they set aside this terrible evil commandment upon them to take the child and put him in the river. They were between a rock and a hard place. But they did what they could. And at first it was enough that they hid him in the house. And it worked for a while. And what a harrowing time that would have been. You know how it is that children can sometimes make noises at times you don't quite expect. And those can be heard very clearly. To try to keep a child hidden for that long, what an interesting and difficult thing. But after a while, it could no longer be that he was kept in the house. So they decided to hide him another way. And did it occur to you that they were, as they were hiding him in the place that they chose, they were actually keeping the king's commandment? They were putting him in the river. They just happened to put a little boat underneath, too. And to put him over in the bulrushes, in the reeds at the side of the river. And then how smart of them to have his older sister Miriam stand guard while they were off doing what they had to do. I appreciate how clever they were in the way that they got around what the king commanded them to do. Doesn't seem like they just excused and went ahead with what the king would wanted them to do just because everybody else was doing it, or because, you know, the king said it, what else can I do? They found a way around the terrible commandment that was upon them. They were clever in that. And I think there's a place for that in parenting. I think it's great that they had the whole family involved in this project with Miriam standing guard there. They were all working together to serve God's purpose despite what the world was calling them to do, the government was calling them to do. you know, there's a direct application here for us now, today. The horror of Moses' day, what they were doing to baby boys in that day, occurred to newborns. It occurred outside of the womb. Children were safe then, at least till they were born. But it is not so in America today. And although our government is not so evil as to command executions of newborn males, it is callous enough to allow killing of the unborn in the womb. And parents today need a vision like Amram and Jochebed had to see that that's not what you do to a child. That's not the right thing. To see the worth of the child and to act the right way. In spite of what others are doing, in spite of what the law permits or allows, to do what God would have you to do. And I want to take a moment right here, and I hope I can do this right, to commend the single mothers in this congregation. And that has happened here a bit. And I'm not commending you for conceiving outside of wedlock. Let's be clear about that. That's not worth commending. But finding yourself with child in that situation, in this society, the concept or possibility of abortion has to come to mind because it is so accessible, because it is allowed. And you chose not to do that. You saw something. You valued that child. In a difficult spot, you valued that child. You chose to bring that child to term. To see that it was a child, not a choice. And there's vision and valor in that. There's one more thing that Moses' parents did, and in an unusual situation, they taught Moses about God. You know, Moses was discovered being hidden in the reeds, in the little ark, by Pharaoh's daughter, and was taken, adopted by her, to be raised in Pharaoh's house. And how wise that Miriam, who was on sentry duty, said, "Do you want me to go find a woman to nurse this baby for you?" And she went and found Jochebed. And it is so ironic that as Pharaoh is trying to take care of all the male children so no male Israelites are going to bother him, in his own house is being raised up the great deliverer, of Israel. But as we understand it, his mother has only got a little bit of time. The time that it would be for a mother to nurse a child, which you can probably extend on to maybe 3 years. 3 years she'd be there nursing that child, and just the first 3 years of his life to be teaching about godliness. After that, it was a Pharaoh's program. It was a Pharaoh's household. And he might have known of his heritage, but there wouldn't be the active teaching. Praise God that in those first 3 years, Jochebed sowed enough seed about the Lord and about who he was, who Moses was, that eventually she raised, what took root in this man, was an idea that God is first. And it was just those few years of instruction, it seems, that led ultimately to the full bloom of a man who was not overcome, by what he could have in Egypt and what the Pharaoh could provide for him. He chose rather to align himself with his people. And when it came time, it says here in Hebrews 11:27, he didn't fear the wrath of the king when it came to making the right decision. Amram and Jochebed taught their child, Moses, about God in a very limited window of opportunity. But look what happened, not only to him, but to the world because of it. Parents, don't underestimate the importance or the power of early Bible teaching. I always get a kick out of the bucket table, I call it, the one where you just drop them into the bucket, and they're in there. And I taught that class once, and I figured out how to know a little bit about teaching all the different classes, even though I was largely clueless on these things. And I was asking Gene, as I always did, you know, what do you do in there? Well, we pat our Bibles. Okay, great. Okay. A little song about that, you know. Okay. This is a lot different from college material that I'm normally covering, you know. But, hey, early teaching in Bible class, you have, and at home, you have no idea what that seed might do someday. Plant it early. Plant it deep. Plant it often. You know, Jochebed knew she wasn't going to have long in Moses' life. And if we're right-thinking parents, we have to realize we might not have long in our children's lives either. We might not get to see them grow up. What a blessing that we do, mostly. But there's an urgency that's required when it comes to teaching. Well, what kind of parent are you? Are you a godly parent? Do you have vision? Do you see the value and importance of your children? Are you brave enough to stand up for what God would want in the midst of a society, in the midst of a nation that at least allows things that are unspeakable to go on? Can you still stand up and do what's right? And can you rise up and teach your children about the importance of God? And more than just teaching them the facts and the drills and the padding the Bible and all of that and the memory verses, can you lead them early to a relationship with the Lord? Can they see themselves early on as disciples? If you can do that, if you can be a godly parent, see if all the rest doesn't take care of itself. You listened very well this morning, and I appreciate that. I wonder who here now, though, needs to make a change. All things are ready. And if you would become a disciple this day, we would have no greater joy than to help you in that. And if you're subject to the gospel call, we can help you in any way. Won't you come now while we stand and while we sing?